The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Ronan Farrow is an investigative reporter and a contributing writer to The New Yorker. He became one of the reporters leading the charge on the Me Too movement with his takedown articles exposing abuse allegations about Harvey Weinstein and other powerful men in media and entertainment. In the process, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, the National Magazine Award, and the George Polk Award, among many other honors. For the past 2 years, he hasn't stopped reporting story after story about abuses of power. His new book, Catch and Kill, tells two stories about the forces that stood in the way of Weinstein's abuses coming to light. One, of Farrow's efforts to track down the producer's accusers, and another of a network of gatekeepers from across media, politics, and business who worked together to ensure their victims stayed quiet. It is also the story of the women who risked everything to expose the truth and an incredibly persistent piece of reporting in the face of extraordinary opposition. The Catch and Kill podcast with Ronan Farrow launched today, and the limited run series includes never before heard interviews and audio recordings with key characters. The podcast provides a deeper understanding of the plot that unravels in the book and features new details and pieces of evidence directly from the investigation. He'll be joined in conversation this evening with Tamala Edwards, anchor of 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition. Please welcome Ronan Farrow and Tamala Edwards.
Good evening and welcome. This man has to catch a train at 9 o'clock tonight, so we are going to pack in as much as we possibly can.
Rapid fire questions.
That's right.
Thank you for doing this.
Oh, absolutely.
And thank you everybody for coming. Thank you.
Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. It reads, it was 400 pages, so I gotta tell you, at first I was like, oh boy. It went so quickly. Fascinating tale. I wanted to start here. Many people reading the book will be shocked by a lot of the things in it, but you come to it from an interesting perspective because you are a child of Hollywood. Between your mother, between your father, stories, bad behavior, the way things work. I was thinking this, on some level, was not news to you, so I wondered what that meant to be doing this story, that a part of you had heard these things all your life growing up, and yet you're discovering this in real time.
I mean, I get variations of this question a fair amount, and I actually have very little insight into it, because I think, you know, we all as journalists bring to the table our personal baggage and history when we report on a story, and as I was entering reporting on the stories that I talk about in Catch and Kill, I wasn't really conscious of the upsides and downsides of that background. It was really more when Harvey Weinstein very aggressively weaponized my family history against me, and it showed up in all these legal threat letters, and it was entwined with this surveillance operation targeting me, that I became conscious of how those things intersected. For me, you know, it was relevant that I had a sister who had dealt with sexual assault and spoken out about it, and I had, as any family member of a survivor of sexual violence, a complicated relationship with that and wanted it to go away, and over the course of the plot, my relationship with it changes, and I seek advice from her. But in terms of factual specifics, you know, I grew up on a farm in Connecticut, so I didn't hear a lot from the cows about Harvey Weinstein.
So you didn't hear that's just the way Hollywood is, or directors are, people behave.
I mean, subsequent to reporting these stories, when I finally got around to, you know, talking to my mom about her experiences, and she was like, oh yeah, this studio head when I was 16, you know, tried to stick his tongue down my throat and I had to run away, and like, that was the way of it. I've heard that a million times now, but it is really striking how going into this reporting, I think for all of us as a culture, we weren't telling those stories.
The other thing that was striking about this is a lot of big names had come at this. Ken Auletta, David Carr, Kim Masters. And he had this predatory history that was shocking, the depth of it. And so for people who may not have read the book yet, I wanted you to quickly lay out, just as you start to wrap your mind around it, that you're taking a whack at this thing that other people have tried and he has shut down over and over, and it is shocking to discover what he's up to.
Yes, and I'm very conscious of that piece of the history of the Harvey Weinstein story, because for this podcast that you just heard about, one of the episodes is about all of those journalists who really tried and tried and tried again to break the story over the years, including Ken Auletta, who's wonderful in his episode of the podcast. Kim Masters is doing it. And I have a lot of respect for those journalists, and one of the moving things in this story is that as these forces are arraying to shut it down, there's also this groundswell of fellow journalists who have absolutely no reason to help me, who have, if anything, competitive incentives not to help me, and yet who really do share whatever they can and give me encouragement that I desperately need at various points in this story, and I owe a lot to them and therefore try to pay tribute to them whenever I can.
And it seems important for people to understand that not only does he go after people with lawyers and other things, there's his very being. I mean, Rebecca Traister, who has been here, the stories of him screaming at people, fighting people, hurting people in ways that are just shocking.
Yeah, I mean, Harvey Weinstein was an intimidating presence, and I often say that the stories that I've reported on about sexual violence are not about sex, they're about the abuse of power. And I think that's an important point. And it's not coincidental that in many of these stories you have individuals who are known for volatile, bullying personalities. And there was a system that sort of accreted around these individuals that permitted that type of behavior. And even for the people who only knew that Harvey Weinstein would, you know, throw things at people and punch people and get into incredibly extreme verbal fights with people, you know, they played a role if they saw those things and were a part of the community that said, well, that's just Harvey. That's just a guy we all have to put up with because he's a part of the fabric of our professional existence. You know, that was, it turns out, part and parcel with much darker forms of abuse. And I think this is a story about the need to hold powerful people accountable in a whole spectrum of ways.
When people, including yourself, would come after him, how did he get so many places to shut it down?
Well, the book is very much about that question and the long history of outlets that killed the Harvey Weinstein story and many other tough stories like it. And I have been very moved by the way in which in the last couple of years we're starting to have a reckoning with the ways in which the free press is the key to exposing these kinds of stories of the abuse of power and ensuring that people are protected going forward, but also sometimes the key to why the truth was suppressed for as long as it was.
He had a pattern where he tells somebody, I want to have a meeting. They go to this meeting. The meeting would go from a public place to a private place. It would start out with a woman in the room who disappears quickly, and then they're left alone with Harvey. Things would happen. The person would appear. It would be clear something horrible had happened, and they would somewhat disappear. Lots of people knew. People participated in that pattern. It was so many people, I was shocked that it went on for so long, over and over and over again. And people almost became desensitized to it. They knew what they were doing, and yet they did it again.
In this question of culpability, I think there are a lot of shades of gray. And all of the people around Harvey Weinstein at a working level, you know, not the fellow studio heads and the network and newspaper heads who made decisions about whether to cover this or not, but the little guys, the assistants, they have a complicated relationship with their role in it. And many of them are incredibly brave whistleblowers who came forward and helped to out the truth. But many of them, I think not inappropriately, also have feelings of guilt about what they knew. And, you know, I've had sources who would say on the record, you know, I looked into women's eyes and saw how frightened they were as I led them out of these meetings, and I knew something had happened. And then months later, as assistants were facing legal jeopardy even over these accusations of complicity, would come back and say, well, I'm not sure I really meant that. You know, maybe I overstated that. So I think that for the rest of their lives, many of those people who facilitated those interactions you're talking about will grapple with what their responsibility was and did they do enough to stop it. And, you know, the answer is different in every case. And you talk about this in careful, nuanced terms because you're a careful, nuanced journalist, and I've tried to do the same in all of my writing about these stories, you know, to describe with some specificity and care the complicated situation those men and women were in. But I think in a lot of headlines after the fact, they've been, you know, skewered in a way that's very black and white.
Other journalists taking a whack at this find themselves beset by two things: the legalities of being shut down and their outlets saying, okay, we give up. And also the people, the women they were trying to talk to, and often just not being willing to cross the bridge to tell a story, to break a non-disclosure, to put a name to it. You manage in some key cases to do that. And I wondered, as you look back on it, did you think it was about the moment that you were doing TV, not print, that you had your own background that maybe made you sensitive to it? What do you think was the turnkey in this moment? You spent a lot of time with a lot of these people, lots of conversations, but I would imagine other journalists had tried that as well. What do you think made the difference with you?
Well, I think the culture was changing in a way that was meaningful to that question. It was still an incredibly difficult conversation that I was having with these sources, and at times for some of them it took months, and they really had to grapple with whether they were going to upend their lives. But at the very least, I was able to point to some thin sort of filaments of precedent in a way that maybe previous reporters hadn't been able to 10 years before, 20 years before. And I was able to say, look, you know, those Cosby accusers haven't gone away. They keep coming back and back and back. And I've written publicly about my efforts to cover Cosby even as recently as 5-6 years ago, and how different that was to the climate today. You know, the way my sister spoke out and really faced smearing and backlash, but still stayed strong and kept her voice out there. The way Gretchen Carlson and other women at Fox News outed the scandal there, it allowed me to say, hey, you know, this is gonna be really hard, but maybe people will listen.
Some of the names that come up in the book are people that you may not know, and you could see Harvey saying, who is she? She's a nobody, I'm me. But now here's some of the names of the women he did this to: Rosanna Arquette, Rose McGowan, Asia Argento, Annabella Sciorra, Mira Savino. And the story over and over is the same. One way or the other, they disappear. Careers that are on fire just stop. I was surprised that so many women who you think would have been at a point to come back at him, that he was so powerful that even they just disappear.
And it can't be overstated how terrified those women were. You know, I walk you through the conversations with each of those sources in the book, and Mira Sorvino, Rosanna, they were so freaked out. And, you know, these are very sophisticated actors in the sense of being individuals on the world stage, not just in the sense of their profession. They know what's up, and they've seen a lot of bad stuff, and this particular set of experiences just chilled them to their core. And part of it was this aspect that you talk about, that their careers seemed to have disappeared for reasons that they couldn't fully explain and felt convinced were related to their rejecting these advances from Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, particularly when you're talking to people who are as sophisticated as some of the women you just named, you know, they are forthright about saying, I know I may never be able to prove this, but here's what I believe. And it's been interesting in the last couple of years seeing that we've had something pretty close to proof in some of these cases. You know, in the case of Mira Sorvino and Ashley Judd, Peter Jackson came forward and said, yeah, I blacklisted them. You know, Harvey Weinstein told me they were impossible to work with and to stand down from a plan to cast them in Lord of the Rings. And he should really be commended for that, because it's not something that people are often open about. But there really was a smear campaign that targeted these women.
You get something that other people hadn't got, which is you get a young lady who had him on tape, and a computer in the back of her closet had kept a copy of this tape that you ultimately get her to share with you. How big was that, do you think, in pushing this story over?
It was so huge, and you know, I think it's unfortunately very rare that in an important investigative story you have that added element of being able to hear a taped confession. And the impact that had on how the story unfolded publicly can't be overstated. And I can't take credit for that impact. That's Ambra Gutierrez, this Italian-Filipina model who is such a fascinating, compelling character. I mean, this is the genesis for the podcast that is now rolling out. As I was writing the book, it became so clear that there was more to know about these characters and more to learn from them. And she's the subject of one of these episodes that's coming in the next few weeks. And I want to study what I can learn from her. I mean, she barely spoke English. She was in her early 20s, something like 21, 22. Had just come from Italy, where she had already had bad experiences with powerful men. She was a finalist in the Miss Italy contest, which was run by Silvio Berlusconi, who is no choir boy. I mean, talk about bad luck. She's like, oh God, I'm finally going to get away from that. And then, you know, her first meeting is with Harvey Weinstein. And it really did, joking aside, have a bad experience there, where she escaped exploitative situations because she has this incredible tenacity, and like got her and her model friends out of one of these bunga bunga parties where Berlusconi was, you know, squiring around these young models and all sorts of nasty things were happening. But she was smeared terribly in the press and called an escort and stuff, and then she came to America to try to make it here. And again, is basically, I mean, it seems to me now, looking back on my early 20s from the ripe old age of 31, like a kid, you know, I don't know that I would have the wherewithal to do what she did when I was her age. And she, despite that, despite the language barrier, despite her age, she just has this incredible strength of character and is brilliant. And after Harvey Weinstein groped her, did just everything textbook right. She went to the police. She was extremely upset about it. She told a whole variety of people. She agreed, even in the midst of her sort of panic and upset about this, to go back the next day to participate in a police sting operation where she was going to wear a wire, and was so scared that he was going to, you know, grab her again and discover she was wearing a wire. And he's this, as you alluded to, sort of very physically intimidating presence. So she's, forgive me, scared shitless, and yet perseveres, goes back in. There are undercover officers around, but at one point she's separated from them, and she does make this tape. And then Harvey Weinstein subverts the criminal justice process, and the tape gets buried. And the saga of how the DA's office was manipulated, the saga of how Ambra Gutierrez came to preserve that tape, even though there was a crazy infrastructure that was built to make sure the tape had gone away, and Harvey Weinstein was convinced that the tape had been destroyed by the district attorney's office. This is Cyrus Vance, the district attorney in Manhattan, still the district attorney in Manhattan. And it's a stranger than fiction saga and a real profile in courage. And that plays out in the book, and it plays out even in further depth in this podcast, where you get to kind of hear her in her own voice talking about all of this.
And so it's the presence of that tape, among other things, when you go to NBC, and there's an effort to flatten, to stop, and then ultimately essentially deny your reporting, that is shocking. And then you begin to learn how many people in the infrastructure, in management, in front of the camera, elsewhere, have issues of their own. And of course, one of the big ones that many of you have heard about were the issues around Matt Lauer. And I wondered if, in the end, when you look back, was it their own issues that they were thinking about, or it was just, we pay this man $20 million a year, he is the franchise, that's why we're shutting this down. At its heart, what was that about?
Well, here again, I'm very careful to only go exactly as far as the facts, which are so carefully scrubbed by one of the senior fact checkers at The New Yorker, and you know, there was an incredibly intensive legal and fact-checking process around all of this.
In other words, if you can get him out for a drink, wow, there's a story.
I'm careful not to overstate, and I'm careful to be very nuanced here about what didn't happen. What is laid out in the book is just hard paper trails of how much secret contact was had between Harvey Weinstein and the executives at NBC. The transcripts and quotes of the promises they made to kill this story before any journalistic judgment was made, and before they ultimately terminated me when I refused to stop reporting on it. The fact that there is a paper trail that proves that this is a company that knew at a very senior level, and the testimonials of senior executives I talked to prove, that they knew about the Lauer allegations, and that this was something that the company was afraid would come out, and that indeed caused them massive problems when it came out. And, you know, I think the assumption you make is pretty fair, that this was someone that a lot of resources were riding on, and that goes a long way towards explaining some of the stories you see in the book, like, you know, a woman named Melissa Lawner, who did a very brave thing in, just finally grappling with this, I think, now that it's out in the public, but is still under a restrictive NDA and still limited in what she can say, and is one of the people who complained in the company. She told Ann Curry. Ann Curry goes on the record talking about that. And then there is an effort to keep her at the company long enough so that the statute of limitations on what she went through lapses. And then she's paid out and has this crazy NDA that everyone around her said was incredibly unusual and was meant to shut her up. And, you know, all of NBC's denials are in there very clearly. They claim this is all coincidental, that they were again and again paying out women who had been abused and giving them these massive, what they called enhanced severance packages in exchange for signing these NDAs that left them terrified and unable to speak about these experiences. And in the controversy that has ensued in the wake of this book coming out, they have kind of half claimed that they're going to release women from those agreements, but also required them to come in and seek approval if they want to be released from them, and they refuse to do an investigation, so those women don't have a lot of faith that they can go in and do that.
They've been really hit by not getting an outside investigator. Do you think eventually they're going to have to, or they hold the line with their own internal investigation?
I end up making this point a lot. I'm not an activist on this issue. My job is to make sure that the facts are completely bulletproof, and clearly they have been. Their own journalists have gotten on air, like Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes, and said, you know, this is something we need to investigate. And Maddow specifically said, I've corroborated the claims in this book that they killed the story. That's an extraordinarily brave thing. We all know it's tough to speak out against your bosses, and she really did that. I think that faith in our news organizations is really important, especially in this moment where we see authoritarian rhetoric weaponized against this important constitutionally protected profession. And the only way to restore faith in a news organization that has acted in this way is to have an outside investigation and real change. And eventually CBS, which I did similar reporting on, did finally have that after dragging their feet for a long time. I don't know if that will happen here, but I know that every journalist in that building seems to want that.
Noah Oppenheim, the head of NBC News, and Andy Lack, the head of NBC, come out really poorly in this book, to say the least. And it is hard to get to the book and imagine how they survived this. You're not, as you point out, you're not an activist. You don't know what would happen. But if you'd have to guess, where do those two land?
Well, you know, every chain of command in a corporation is different. And this is very much the story, as is the case with a number of stories I've reported on, of mutual protection in a corporate chain of command. And men accused of serious misconduct and very particular views about women and whether these kinds of claims matter, who look out for each other, and because they're at risk of going down together, will shield each other to the bitter end. And You know, you saw these incredible transcripts of CBS board meetings after my stories about that network came out, where there was literally a guy on that board saying, I don't care if it's 16 women accusing him of rape, you know, he's our guy, and he's essential to the bottom line of this company. This is referring to Les Moonves. I mean, crazy, like, mustache-twirling villain dialogue that seems overwritten. And those conversations really do happen at companies, and they really do make this mistake of thinking that leadership change and investigation and transparency is some kind of loss or failure, that they've lost a fight if they accede to that. But it's the only way to restore confidence in the end.
As the book goes on, you get into the world of spies, the world of lawyers, the world of the National Enquirer. You need to take a bath when you finish the book. You know, and overall, if you step back and you look at the role of spies and lawyers, it feels like if one doesn't get you, the other one will. And you talk about the things that you go through, moving apartments, running through traffic, putting your notes in a safe deposit box with a note that essentially says, if I turn up dead, here are the notes, facing down lawyers. But when it's all said and done, it feels like this isn't just about this particular story. If somebody has the money, they can do all of this. They can get the lawyers, they can get the spies.
That's the point of the story. I mean, I hope that I've managed to tell it in a way that's not just about navel-gazing or about me. It's significant because these are systems that are alive and well and really highlight the disparity between the haves and the have-nots in this country. And not just the haves, but the extreme haves, the most connected and influential people, they really do routinely subvert the criminal justice system and subvert the media and turn those systems into instruments of suppression on their behalf. And I think people have been pretty startled by the stranger-than-fiction kind of exotic tactics mm-hmm. that get used. But that's real. You know, that's not a conspiracy theory. It's a real conspiracy. And it's important that we all take a hard look at that.
In fact, you show how the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, shutting down pro bono groups that fight for citizen rights, there are any number of areas that you ought to be scared about the range of AI, about technology, and what people are able to do.
Yeah, these tools are getting more and more sophisticated, and what she's referring to specifically is this kind of underbelly of journalist and dissident hunting that intersects with these powerful circles of men seeking to shield themselves. And sometimes it's regimes seeking to shield themselves and, you know, members of Saudi leadership seeking to shield themselves and retaliate against people who criticize them. And the plot that I unravel really does lead all the way to some of these same actors in the espionage world being involved in the murder of Khashoggi. Mm-hmm. And some of these high-tech tools that are used to track people and their phones, and I experienced a variant of that at one point in the plot, those are thriving industries. And they are technologies that are being used to kill people and stifle the truth. And we're really lucky to be in a country where we're still pretty protected from the most extreme versions of that. But even the way you see in this story those same tactics encroaching into American life is pretty scary.
Does it infuriate you when you see people doing things like the 10-year challenge on Facebook and they don't realize they're just giving AI companies
data to the Russians?
You know, data.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's probably a small emblem of a much larger whole, which is we have not fully reckoned with all of these sinister applications of our everyday technologies, and there's a whole subplot in this book and in the first episode of the podcast, which you can download now on Apple Podcasts. please rate and review right now, about this software made by an Israeli cyber firm called NSO Group. The software is called Pegasus, and it's used to basically hijack your phone and turn it into a recording device. And you know, the company that makes it says, we just sell this to governments to help hunt criminals. And I have to be careful what I say here, but They do, and that's true in some cases, but also all over the world again and again, when journalists wind up dead, it turns out they or people around them have this software on their phone. They've been infected. So that was true of Khashoggi's friends. It was true of Javier Valdez, the journalist who was pumped full of bullets in Mexico. It's a pattern around the world. And we have no tools to control this. There's not even really a conversation about the kinds of reforms that would be necessary to prevent all sorts of regimes from using this software in nefarious ways. And again, I have to be careful about how much I say about potential ongoing reporting, but there's a need for that conversation in this country too.
The effects of the Me Too movement. We've seen some powerful people affected, but this is a pretty big subject. When you look at where you are now, do you feel as though things have really changed, or just barely?
I think it's very clear from the reporting that I've done and the conversations I continue to have with sources that the fight for accountability is just starting. And yet, I emerge from all this reporting optimistic on some level, because it's also clear to me that the sources aren't shutting up anytime soon, and the journalists, like some of the ones you listed earlier, like some of the ones that are profiled in the podcast and the book, aren't stopping anytime soon. So there's a long way to go and a lot of fighting left to do, but I just believe that the truth will out.
So you're a man, so you're in rooms sometimes where we are not, and do men say to you, "I'm afraid to say anything to women now," and what do you say back?
Well, the men who would be inclined to say that very often just hang up on me when I call. And then I have to call them back and say, it's not about you, I'm actually just asking you for information for a story that is about someone else. Thank you for that telling reaction. I understand that there is an adjacent conversation to some of the subjects we've been talking about that is more about gray areas and the space for men in leadership positions to mentor young people, particularly of the opposite gender, and whether there's a chilling effect on sort of positive interactions in the workplace because of this. And look, those are valid conversations to have. They just don't rise to the level of my caring that much. I mean, that...
I'm with you, but I thought it was a valid question.
I think it's great that we're having renewed conversations about that, and I have a high degree of confidence that we'll all sort it out, and you can mentor young women in your office with the door open or whatever. Have glass walls in your office. We're already doing it. It's fine. It's fine. The reporting that I've done is about serious crimes.
Right.
And it doesn't really intersect with those subtler workplace conversations, which I have every faith will play out in a way that is not without difficulty, but that activists will steer in a good and compelling way and will find equilibrium on.
A section of the book deals with the National Enquirer and its role in gathering catch and kill stories, in particular, on behest of the president. And what stood out to me at the end is, after your work has all these ripples across the, for Les Moonves and Harvey Weinstein and all these other people, tax returns, Ukrainian phone calls, yeah, that's an issue. Sex assault for him, not being raised as an issue at all. What does that tell you?
I get that question a lot too, and I actually don't buy the argument that Donald Trump would not be responsive to the kind of reporting that was done on Harvey Weinstein, or that he is Teflon on this particular issue. I think certainly the culture needs to take a harder look at the misconduct claims around Donald Trump, and there's some interesting new threads of that type in Catch and Kill. There's a fair amount of Trump-related reporting in it. But the fact is that there hasn't been the kind of watershed reporting, putting it in one place, presenting enough new information to sort of shock the news cycle, and doing it in a way that is so meticulously fact-checked as to be inarguable, where I'm ready to draw that conclusion. No amount of reporting will make anyone care about this. I just don't think we have enough data points to say that. That's not to say that that kind of report won't come or can't be done. But I don't think it's happened yet. And that is not at all to discount many of the claims, which are quite credible. But you know, the context in which those claims emerge and the critical mass of sourcing, that's all important. And, you know, on one level, when I see someone like Eugene Carroll come forward with a very serious accusation, but it's in a memoir where she's making a lot of accusations against a lot of different men, all of which may be true, I haven't investigated any of those claims, it strikes me as something of a missed opportunity, because while I'm very happy to see anyone kind of speak their truth, and I hope she found the reaction to that book fulfilling, it does mean that it's a flash in the pan in the news cycle. Instead of, you know, if she had gone to a credible investigative reporter and waited it out to make it about something that is bigger, mm-hmm. and that is corroborated in a way where it's going to be of greater significance, it might have had greater impact, if it indeed checks out. Again, I can't speak to the facts of that one. But we haven't seen that. We've seen a lot of piecemeal claims, mm-hmm. and that is an interesting dilemma for us in the press. You know, what do you do when there is so much out there and it is not new anymore? So you can't sort of store it up and reach a critical mass in the way that the Harvey Weinstein story developed. And I don't know, maybe we'll see the answer to that, and some journalist will break through that with Donald Trump.
Over and over again, what stays with you in this book are the stories of many of the women and what happened to them. And the one that I think really struck me the most was Annabella Shura, who I just remember loving her work, and she was doing great, and there she goes. And there's a very emotional back and forth between her and Rosie Perez, where they pretty much just melt, and Rosie pushes her, you've got to do this, you've got to go forward. And I remember thinking when I read it in the magazine, no matter what happens, she doesn't get it back. She doesn't get who she was and who she would have been back. And so I wondered your perspective on what that means for these women looking back and going forward now that they've told their stories.
I have that reaction to Annabella Shura, and specifically to that exchange with Rosie Perez, who is so unbelievably eloquent in this book and gives this quote about kind of trying to hold Annabella together and give her some hope that she will be better someday to some extent and find a way out of the pain. It really devastates me every time, and I grappled a lot with, you know, already this was a story where to tell it, I knew I had to be quite vulnerable and open about myself, and that I would be doing the thing that we never want to do of sort of becoming the story to some extent, because it's partly about an international espionage operation that targeted me. Like, I had to be in it. But it was still another layer of a difficult dilemma to try to figure out how much of my reaction emotionally to these stories to put into those moments. And I made the choice in the end to keep myself out of those tracts where I'm talking about the women's stories, because there's just no comparison. You know, the extent of devastation and the way in which that was life-altering to Annabella Shura so eclipses any reaction that I had to it emotionally. So I only glancingly talk about how difficult it was to live in that space of her pain and how I carry that with me. And it's, you know, the initial conversations that we had that she allowed me to, you know, make records of were so unbelievably awful. It reminded me a little bit of that Werner Herzog film, Grizzly Man, where there's a central tape where a guy gets
mauled
and killed, and he talks about the ethical dilemma of, like, what to do with this tape. And in the context of the film, he decides in the end to play footage of him listening to it, but not to play the audio out of respect. And it really felt like that level of raw human anguish, like it was something that no one should ever hear. And I remember talking to my editors a lot about how to do justice to that in this very spare, almost clinical style of these New Yorker pieces, where we didn't ever want to stack the deck in favor of these sources by saying, you know, oh, and she's weeping and she's falling apart. And also there's the risk of if you do that wrong, it's undermining to them. You know, she was doing a very strong thing, and I didn't want to make her seem more fragile than she was because she was really brave. But it was a thing that was awful and almost to the point of her not being able to physically tell it. And, you know, the end result of those editorial fights was, like, we added sentences like, she paused, which doesn't capture it at all. And I think there are a few sentences that where I allude to that, that it was much, much worse than that. But, yes, the answer is that's something that will never, ever leave me.
Most of the women, do they tell you telling the story has made it better for them, done nothing for them? It's out there, but I'm still where I am. Where are they left now, having told the story?
It varies, and I've been immensely heartened that the overwhelming majority have come back to me and talked about how fulfilling this was, and also decided to stay in the fight, whatever that means for them. I mean, Annabella Sciorra, I think, is one of the people who has it hardest, and there are good days and bad days, and she is still really traumatized. But also, she has decided to volunteer to testify in Harvey Weinstein's trial. And that is incredibly brave, and we all, I think, owe her a debt of gratitude for what she did in coming forward in the story, and then now coming forward again, potentially, in the trial. But, you know, that would be one of the most complicated cases where I think she probably has moments of ambivalence, but still on some fundamental level has found it fulfilling enough that she wants to keep going. And, you know, then there are also significantly less complicated cases where it's just been an unalloyed good in someone's life, and often that's because it's people who had the benefit of being in a difficult and upsetting situation, but maybe not quite that degree of violent, life-altering trauma. I mean, Ambra Gutierrez is a wonderful story, partly because she did everything right, and it was an incredibly difficult, upsetting situation, but also she's thriving marvelously. You know, her modeling career is going great, and she has this fabulous life on runways and doing her lingerie shoots, and she has wonderful friends around her. She's very exuberant, and you know, she talks about that in her podcast episode. Like, I did this incredibly difficult thing, and I'm great. And I just, you know, as a reporter, you love to hear that because you're really asking people to go out on such a fragile limb and risk so much. And I am grateful every time that works out okay for people.
One that I'm sure you get as a lawyer and somebody close to this, his trial starts in about 6 weeks mm-hmm. in Manhattan, facing 5 counts. Does he go to jail? Does he beat it? What do you think?
I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I mean, the track record of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is not that great on this issue. So I don't know. And you already see in this early pretrial window how Harvey Weinstein's ever-shifting but always fairly high-powered and well-paid legal team has dismantled various parts of the cases against him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have these situations where the district attorney's office will say in background conversations, like, of course we know this woman's claim is true, but he came at us with these procedural attacks and we had to strike that charge, you know? Procedural attacks, like he's tried to get every cop on the case fired and tried to kind of cast a shadow of doubt over the women because of the conduct of the detectives. Were they too sympathetic? Did they ever, you know, urge a source to not reveal the full array of facts? And, you know, I haven't reported on the specifics of those claims, and in some cases, maybe they've found things that discredited at least one of the cops that they removed from the case. But the collateral damage from those kinds of very underhanded, aggressive tactics is one charge after another has fallen away. And he was even trying, so there was this one cop that he succeeded in doing that to, and then he was trying in the weeks leading up to the release of the book to get rid of the other cop who had been one of the lead investigators for the NYPD on the basis of a claim that she had leaked me the audio. the police audio, which, and there was a whole investigation that was spun up as a result. And I'm sitting there, you know, a week away from this thing releasing with the story of how it definitely did not come from this woman, and just thinking, wow, you know, it never stops. The ability of powerful people to manipulate the justice system just never stops.
Last question from me before we're going to get to some from the crowd. Your sister, who you opened talking about, shows up in the book here and there. You know, in her history, accusing your father, Woody Allen, of child sexual assault, I guess is the proper word, and even as an adult, trying to talk about her truth. And in the end, it's almost wistful and sad. At the end, she's proud of you. But you kind of note she's looking at these other women having this moment where their story goes through, but she's not getting that moment. Do you think it's over for her? Or do you think she may yet get that moment?
Well, it depends what you mean by that moment. I mean, I think her claim has been heard in a way that it wasn't previously. And you know, people who look at that case seriously understand that it's backed by serious evidence, by eyewitness accounts, by forensic evidence. And in terms of the kind of permanent record and how a detailed investigative report can contribute to that, that I think is not over. I mean, that's a particular case where there's just reams and reams of evidence and court records, and they're sort of sitting right there for an investigative journalist to dig into.
All right. So I will look for the cards, which I'm told are coming, so we can get some of your... And like that, the man comes from behind.
Thank you.
We'll start
Grill
with the
me,
one.
Fam. Let's do this. Tough
We've questions. Got about 10 minutes, so...
Did these just come from the crowd of these lovely folks? Or
it
did. They
did.
Come from Twitter, in which case they'll all be horrible and racist.
I don't think it's Twitter.
Okay,
How do you deal with not knowing more than one verifiable source on a story? When would you take a chance and just go with one?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, it would be so case by case. I've never personally reported a story about these particular kinds of serious crimes where there wasn't some element of a pattern or an MO that I was reporting on. I think it would depend on the level of physical evidence and records.
This one's really interesting. How do you feel about people calling your book a page-turner and sharing it as a piece of entertainment versus as a recounting of women's trauma? Is it possible that the general public can only stomach sexual violence and women's trauma as entertainment?
So there was a...
Deep, whoever wrote that.
There was I can't remember if it was Slate or Salon, a really thoughtful article about this question that basically made the argument, which I, for obvious reasons, was quite happy with, that this was such a smart approach to that question, that the book being so much a compulsive, readable thriller was a way to get these hard truths across to a much wider audience that otherwise wouldn't have access to that. And I basically believe in that argument. I mean, I think that whether a story is rendered in the very, very dry, clinical style of a New Yorker article, or the style of this book, which is very, very carefully fact-checked reporting, but in the shape of a narrative with character arcs and a lot of sort of vividness, and there's humor in there, and there's all sorts of emotion in there, or whether it's recapitulated, as many important pieces of journalism about serious crimes have been, in the form of like a dramatization, you know, All the President's Men. Mm-hmm. By the way, a body of reporting whose legacy is very much wrapped up in the dramatized movie version of it. I think that there is a valid place for all of those versions, and I think that that op-ed strikes me as being correct, that actually in each of those forms, as different as they are, there is wisdom in making the story compelling. I mean, even in the form of those New Yorker articles, there is a commitment to making people understand a compelling truth in a way that is vivid and that connects. And part of my job as a journalist is, in addition to being fair and precise and legalistic, also creating a story that will capture people in a way where they'll think about those hard truths. So I actually don't find tension between those two things.
Somebody writes, was there ever a moment when you felt like giving up on the story? I'll just say for you, multiple times. It's all in the book.
Read the book.
Democrats appear to be paying the
Sign
penalty.
Sign up for the podcast.
Democrats appear to be paying the penalty for sexual predation and Republicans less so. What changes could level the playing field?
I don't know.
Do you
that,
agree with that?
I don't
or disagree
know.
With
I don't
that?
Know that we have enough data points to draw that conclusion. I mean, it is true. A significant majority of the stories that I've done in this particular area have been about powerful Democrats, but it's still too small a sample size to say that that's sort of the broader cultural state of things. And I've done several stories on powerful Republicans too. So. Well, for me as a reporter, I know you're trying to move through these economically.
Okay.
You're such a pro.
Go for it.
I really resent and am frustrated by the imposition of partisanship on these stories, which I find to be fundamentally nonpartisan. Hmm. This is about criminal activity. My own motive, even my crassest, most self-interested motive, is that of a reporter who wants the big scoop and to get it as right as possible. And I can honestly tell you the party of the people involved has never played into it. And it's wild to come at stories from that approach and then see in the sort of Twitter reaction and the cable news reaction afterwards it getting turned into partisan headlines and actually separate sets of headlines for what are now very separate sets of media where, you know, I report on a Harvey Weinstein or an Eric Schneiderman, the Democratic Attorney General of New York, who was a big Trump opponent. And, you know, I'm getting all of these tweets from, like, Rachel Maddow viewers saying, you know, Rachel, how dare you talk about this guy's reporting? He's clearly a Trump plant, you know, with a vendetta against powerful Democrats. I've, like, screenshotted these because they're so wild to me. And then a month later, I report on a Brett Kavanaugh or something, and it's this huge troll farm that spins up saying, you know, he's a hack, and, you know, how dare he? He's clearly got an agenda against Republicans. Why has he never reported on a Democrat? And it really is like there is complete short-term memory problems. Or there's just no interaction between these two sides of the country anymore, so they're seeing the curated headlines about the side of the thing that they are invested in and not the wider whole. And as someone who is always going to go for the story regardless of the politics involved, it's very frustrating to see it recast in that framework.
What do you know about the National Enquirer deleting, shredding Trump's information? It's in the book.
It's in the book.
Bill Cosby was convicted. R. Kelly has been charged. Is some form of white privilege protecting Harvey Weinstein from consequences?
I mean, I generally think white privilege informs how the legal system works. I would say that there's multiple important forms of privilege going on with Harvey Weinstein. You know, each of these cases is different. Certainly, I think the Cosby story illustrates how wealth and profile are important shields and protected him even as a black man in the criminal justice system for years and years and years. Yeah, and we'll have to see how the Harvey Weinstein case plays out.
This one's wild. Do you think Jeffrey Epstein was murdered?
The answer is I don't know. We actually had editorial conversations when writing about Epstein's death in the book, and I think landed on language like, you know, dead of an apparent suicide. I think that a lot of the things that people talk about as being fishy around those circumstances could also be general ineptitude. I mean, clearly, indisputably, many things went wrong. And then the question is, how many of those are things that are just going wrong all the time in those facilities? Mm-hmm. And that the, you know, the impediment to understanding how common those problems is that we don't want to admit to that. And people are covering each other's asses. So I don't know. I mean, there again, I come at this as a reporter, and I haven't done specific enough reporting on that to answer.
Quickly, people want to know, do you think you're still under surveillance, and what are you working on next? If you can't get into the details, they just want a general topic.
Yes, and I can't give you a general topic.
We support your amazing work. How is it possible to fact check when it's he said, she said?
Well, I think the answer is, in the stories I've chosen to publish, it's not just he said, she said. And one of the positive transformations in journalism in recent years has been to understand, and I think that, you know, my stories and the stories of a number of other great journalists, Megan Toohey and Jody Cantor at the Times, you know, wonderful reporters who have worked on the Epstein story. There's a whole community. One of the contributions of that work is to take stories of sexual violence out of the realm of he said, she said. In some cases, the body of evidence may turn it into a he said, she said, and in other cases, not. In other cases, there's eyewitnesses that see people go in and out of rooms. There's what, in legal terms, is often described as prompt outcry witnesses, where we place in the criminal justice system an elevated premium on statements that are made in a state of heightened emotion right after an event, and very often you have those in a case like this. Very often there is a paper trail of settlements that can point to the truth of a situation. Sometimes there's recordings, as was the case in the Harvey Weinstein story. The Harvey Weinstein story was the archetypal example of a story that couldn't be broken because it's a he said, she said topic. And that just clearly was not the case. There was a really compelling body of evidence that made it about fact versus non-fact, not at all about he said, she said. So I think one of the things I'd like to see come out of this particular moment in journalism is to understand that any kind of criminal allegation, sexual or not, can be a he said, she said, or can be backed by significant evidence, and it should just be taken on a case-by-case basis. The specific area of sex crimes shouldn't be ghettoized or segregated into some realm of unprovability just because it's an uncomfortable topic.
Last question, and it's a fun one. From Dave.
Thank God.
Do you have a really great singing voice? This must be an inside joke. I don't know why Dave wants to know this.
Yeah, I do. Thank you, guys. This was so fun. Let's do it again. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time.
I will now spirit you back.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.